If you remember, I don't know if you're a member of the ARRL, but if you are the member of the ARRL, you can actually pull up previous issues of QEX. It's the November-December issue in 2012. I will, when I have a chance, probably during the Astronomy Net, put a link to the article. But you have to understand that Jeff is a scientist. He kind of deals in a slightly parallel world than amateur radio, for the sake of amateur radio. These are very nicely written articles. They're not particularly peer-reviewed. There's a whole process that goes on for scientific journals that don't happen even in the best quality popular magazine articles. So I think you're kind of talking apples oranges, the two of you. But, you know, if Jeff would like to kind of focus the conversation a little bit better, if I'm misinterpreting, please feel free.
Absolutely, Dr. Roy, just what you said, ECTPL. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we kind of agree. I mean, I'll, for anyone interested, it was an interesting article. The idea that it was an interesting article that was advanced to a large, relatively large group of people. I used to subscribe to QEX when it wasn't free. It doesn't really make any sense to me to pay extra to get a printed version if I can get a non-printed version for free. So I discontinued my subscription, but that pretty much no one took it and did anything with it kind of strikes me as, if you look at the nooks and crannies, there's got to be a couple of negatives about this design. And again, all things being equal, when something sounds too good to be true, it's usually because it's too good to be true.
Yes, thank you very much for your attention. Also, I didn't recognize your voice. Dr. Roy is not better in it. And to you.
Okay, once again, there was a gentleman who said he had a question, and he did not respond. I don't want to kind of forget about him. So if the gentleman is still out there and still has a question, please feel free.
Hi, name is Ivan. AE2ALD had a question about D-Star.
Oh, well, if you want to, we could just put you down for the next question once we finish this up. It probably is kind of done. So just stand by for a little while, and then I'll get to you. How's that?
Roger that. Thank you.
Okay, so back to you, Wesley.
Actually, we beat the bushes about those antennas, so I have no more to say. I think it's time to give a microphone to somebody else and to exceed.
Okay, very good, Wes. Thank you for participating. So, Ivan, you're up next. Can I get your call sign slowly? Repeat it again to me so I make sure I get it right.
Hello, Echo 2 Alpha Lima Papa, KD2ALP.
Okay, very good, Ivan. So what's your question about D-Star?
Well, I'm trying to comprehend and wrap my mind around the whole system. Trying to get into D-Star. I got my radio, which is just a handheld Kenwood 74, but it's D-Star capable. And I don't have a hotspot yet, but I was able to reach the only repeater, D-Star capable repeater in Westbury, Nassau County, which is about 15 miles away from where I'm located at the border of Eagle Park and Forest Hills. I just have a question. So I'm going transmitting into the gateway of that repeater, talking with the rest of the world, with people all over the world on that reflector that I connected to. That also means that I'm holding up the repeater, just a digital voice G-Star repeater for everybody locally who wants to get on that repeater and talk as we normally would on a regular repeater, but just through a G-Star modulation. And they would have to wait until I get off that gateway. Or if it works like some kind of echo link where everybody on the internet can have multiple conversations at the same time and nobody hears each other or is interfering.
AC2GS. Well, that would be wonderful if that was done, but not how DSAR unfortunately works. So your first premise is the correct one, which I think what has driven the popularity of hotspots, because you're basically taking over a repeater. Now, if everyone locally is interested in communicating in the same reflector, then it's okay. But invariably, you might want to talk to some group of people in Romania, and most of the other people locally don't really speak Romanian, so you'll get into arguments of taking over the repeater. So you were right the first time. It is an inherent design flaw that it doesn't have the kind of multi-threaded output that you suggested as your second option. You're basically commandeering a local repeater for the sake of the reflector you've linked it to, and it's going to be there until you cut the link or you time out the link.
Oh, okay. So even though I'm transmitting into the way internet, people still can't talk. Oh, I'm just apologizing again. Because I was just talking to the rest of the world, and, you know, it was always quiet. And, but that thought just occurred to me. What if I'm holding up the repeater, just the analog digital voice type thing, people can get on it. Thank you for clearing that out. I guess I'm better off just getting a hotspot than just using the Raspberry repeater. And maybe get on that repeater just for voice-to-voice communication, the range of the repeater about on the D-Star modulation. And in fact, I'm kind of surprised how it's more and more people are getting on D-Star. Even on Simplex, I was able to have a few cell with somebody around, I forgot the call sign of a person. And yes, it was just simple Simplex calling D-Star, and I got an answer.
Okay, that's kind of unusual these days. DSTAR kind of peaked around 8-9 years ago. Then DMR became very popular. Then Fusion was added to the mix. And, you know, we used to have locally about 3 DSTAR repeaters. I think that we're now down, at least I'm locally down to 1. As far as DSTAR, ICOM is a proprietary protocol that ICOM shared with, I think, the Japanese Amateur Radio Club, and they have enabled it on their HF radio. So theoretically, you could go down to 40 meters and talk simplex to some guy using DSTAR. I've never heard it. I probably wouldn't recognize it if I did hear it, so that might be the answer. But it's certainly possible and relatively legitimate to use it on the phone portions of the band. You can't kind of finagle with the FCC and use it for the data or the CW regions. But if you stay on the phone regions, theoretically you can transmit using DSTAR on 40 and 80 and 160.
Oh, wow, that's cool. That's good to know. Thank you for clearing that out for me. I'm going to just keep exploring DSTAR, maybe, you know, just because my radio came with, and I don't have any other digital modes. But with that said, I have my sort of story jumping around. My last question about VHF and UHF propagation. When I was taking my exam, I believe there was no correlation between day and night patterns on VHF and UHF, but for some strange reason, it's every day I witnessed that my reception and my transmissions are much clearer and better during the night hours rather than during the day. On VHF and UHF, I use all the 2 meters to even to reach that DSTAR Raspberry repeater. I always get more luck during the night hours. I almost half the time I'll get it on during the daytime. Does that make any sense? I know HF frequencies are more subject to weather conditions and atmospheric conditions in general, but not VHF and UHF. Over.
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated. It's not only the weather with HF. There's two ways of propagating signals. There's ground wave propagation and there's sky wave propagation. Local propagation is usually ground wave. Distance DX is usually sky wave. That's where we start to talk about the ionosphere and propagation conditions and how different times of day affect the ionosphere in positive and negative ways. When it's sunny out, the lower layers of the ionosphere are lit up and they produce a lot of extra background noise on 160 meters and 80 meters and make it unusable. But it also lights up during sunspot cycles, F1, F2, and that makes the 10 meters possible to be used. When you get past 6 meters of most of the electromagnetic waves that go up into the sky are not going to refract down. They go straight through. So you get little to no sky wave propagation with UHF, VHF. It's all ground waves. And because it's absorbed by ground level obstructions much worse, elevation is the most important. So point to point elevation of antennas is the most important principle for UHF, VHF function. You can have the degree of weather affected propagation, but it's you know, orders of magnitude less severe than the sky wave propagation changes in the weather and the time of day and the seasons and the sunspot cycles. Yes, certainly, Ed. Please, add to that.
I have given a presentation on the subject of radio to non-AM audience. And keep it nice and simple. My comment is that you can get very, very nice ionospheric reflection, but it depends upon the ionization level of the ionosphere, which are, to use a highly professional term, many variables. And I think that puts it very well. And some people who are familiar with Rumble classes nod their heads and say, yeah, that's it. Different subject, just curious. With your, you know, with your propagation test, what kind of antenna are you using on your end?
I'm using KE2AOP. I'm using a diamond, right even right now, diamond 77, I forgot which one it was, 440 and 2-meter antenna. Still, I don't know why, but night hours seem to be better than the hours with the same antenna, regardless of the weather pattern. I don't know how does that relate to UHF frequencies, but they usually meant for ground propagation, point-to-point, line of sight. So yeah, but that's the antenna I'm using.
K0BD.
Alpha Charlie 2 Papa.
Say again, Ed. Another person wanted to break in with a comment.
Should I continue or defer to the new caller? Your choice.
Yeah, well, let's hear what the other person says, and we can get back to you, Ed, right?
Okay.
So I forget the call sign. I think it ends in VD.
Kilowatt zero, bravo, bravo.
Oh, okay. Ryan?
Yeah, I've noticed, well, I think it has to do with background noise. I mean, the person mentioned they're in Forest Hills or on the border of Rego Park and Forest Hills. Here in Manhattan, I experienced the same thing. I think it has to do with the number of people who switch on their microwaves or something. You know what I mean? Like, there's background noise, especially on UHF, that I think has to do with interference from the urban environment, K0BD.
Yeah, very good, Ryan. I was kind of thinking the same thing. It could be something as simple as a solar array in the neighborhood. Those inverters have a nasty habit of spewing a lot of noise. So, and they're active during the day, and they're not active in the middle of the night. So in your particular case, Ivan, it might be more related to interference rather than propagation changes. But Ed, I promise to get back to you, so consider this getting back to you.
So my point is, I think the type of antenna he's using might have some, you know, relation to this. And I'm always saying to people, what kind of antenna are you using? And they always give me the make and model. No, I mean describe the antenna. The thing is short and simple, how big is it? How does it compare to a 19-inch clip?
Ivan?
Couldn't make out Ed because he was, at least from where I'm at, he sounded too far away.
Okay, no problem. I'll relay. Hopefully you can hear me. He wants to know the quality of the antenna. He wants to know the length of the antenna. I assume it's a standard vertical with some radials at the bottom. So he would like to know how long it is.
Well, basically, what type of antenna?
Okay, he wants to know what type and how long it is.
Oh, it's a rubber ducky antenna aftermarket diamond, 15 inches long. However, I'm standing on the sixth floor of my apartment. That played a role.
15 inch long, which antenna?
Handheld antenna.
That's a lot better than the standard question antenna, but if you are serious about this, you might want to try using a more serious antenna than a rubber question antenna. I have always found that performance people want to be desired.
Hey, C2PL.
Yes, Jeff?
Sometimes people don't have access to the roof.
Doesn't have to be on the roof.
I was going to put my antenna on the on my AC unit outside, and just before I did that, somebody else did, and you all got a notice in my building. Nothing on the so it's a violation. We got a DOB violation and everything else for sticking something outside and putting it on top of AC. However, the question about antenna wasn't really motivated by my desire for a better signal or wider range. Just the point was the difference between night and day, and which somebody pointed out it could be just an urban environment and background noise. Basically, you connected to technology or technogenic factors, rather than nature of VHF and UHF wave propagation.
Yeah, Ivan, as far as I'm aware, there's no significant diurnal activity change in propagation at UHF and VHF frequencies. Again, anyone want to tell me I'm completely wrong, feel free, but I haven't read anything on that. So, again, it's probably, if it's consistently day in and day out, it's probably something that's running during the daytime and not running during the nighttime in your neighborhood that's generating more of a background noise. You know, all neighborhoods have their own characteristic noise patterns throughout the day and the week.
K0DD.
Okay, I think I heard Ed, and I also heard Ryan. So Ed, the first.
A few thoughts. I have been using this repeater since 1974 in some very weird places, and I've never really noticed that night-to-day effect. Then again, most of my time in a heavily urban environment was before everybody and his brother had a solar array with inverters on the roof. So that may have, there may be a lot to what you said there, Roy. Second item, a suggestion for an apartment. A vertical dipole hanging inside the window. It's it's about, you know, about the same length as a yardstick. You have, you know, 19 inches above the sensor insulator, 19 inches below the sensor insulator with a coax in the middle, and hanging down basically to fill up the inside of the window. That should work fairly well, and a lot better than a lot of other antennas.
Yeah, it certainly is a plan, especially if the windows are not clad in metal, but some insulating material like vinyl or wood.
BHD coming.
Yes, Jim.
Good evening, folks. KD2BHD, Jim, Bayport. It's funny, I was thinking when Wesley was speaking about the foil antennas that they have a unique little niche being put on the inside of windows when the closest you're allowed to get to the outside in your apartment is the inside face of the window. The very closest you can get to an outside antenna is a foil antenna on the window. And these two conversations coincide perfectly on that topic.
Yeah, we talked about this a month or two ago. I think it's still available. It's not as readily available as it once was, but I think you could still scrape it up.
Yeah, 19 inches on one planing ledge, 19 inches on the other one. Solid sensor up for one, the shield for the other, bingo.
K0DD.
Yes, Ryan?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's just to the point of the noise, the original question about noise in the day and the night, or that, you know, how to test that, it's fairly simple. He said he has a Kenwood radio, probably has a good S meter. If you find that you're having bad reception, check the noise, check the background noise. If you find you're having good reception, check the background noise. If you have an SDR that can record levels over time, that's even better, but you could just do that with your handheld, just check the noise, you know, the background noise. You can hit the monitor button and check the S meter, K0BB.
It also would sound different.
Times, but it's during the night, much like night, that I'm especially the star receiver in Metro Nassau County that I was talking about earlier. Right now, I can get on it really quick without a problem. But I definitely will check the noise level. I think it occurred to me on my handheld. Thank you for that. Bye.
And listen to how the noise sounds. Boy, should I elaborate?
Certainly, but in addition, I think we should have a very short chat about how all frequencies are interacted by the ionosphere, and it's just a matter of how much you pump up the ionosphere. That might be an interesting thread to pull on.
I'm not sure I understand that, but what I wanted to say was true noise is Gaussian noise. It is a function of the universe, and it has a kind of unique sound, whereas most terrestrial interference, some are coherent, and it sounds different. It may be a little bit of strange or hearing, but you can hear the difference. It just sounds a little different. I mean, neither one's any good, but they sound different. Why would you get a minute to clarify?
No, earlier tonight you mentioned that you gave that talk to the non-technical people, and it sort of sounded like you were saying that all RF can be interacted with the ionosphere. It's just sort of how strong the ionosphere is, or at least that's what it sounded like to me. I could have misheard you entirely.
No, I very simply misspoke entirely. I am talking about primarily the range of 10 to 30 megahertz, really. That is where the ionic flare has the greatest effect. Once you go outside that, it drops off fairly rapidly.
Okay, fine. So we end up agreeing. I mean, there are some people who don't quite realize far below the ionosphere there's dusting that goes on when the weather pattern has thermal inversions over large bodies of water that produces a similar refraction that the ionosphere does, but it's not ionospheric-based refraction that sometimes will let you propagate UHF and VHF very often from California all the way to Hawaii.
Never mind, if you have a minute, this is really off topic. I can tell you about bending 5 gigahertz transmission.
Okay, that would be interesting. Let's kind of find our way back to Ivan. So hopefully we gave you some things to think about. You should really have the variations, at least from what I'm aware of UHF, VHF, from pure propagation conditions. It's much more likely a series of environmental. And so what Ed said was right. There's natural noise, which tends to have a Gaussian distribution, and then there are artificial electromechanically induced noises that each and every one of them has their own interesting pattern, and there are guys out there with such good ears that they could listen to noise and they could tell you if it's some part of your car or some inverter on a power supply or solar battery type of thing and all kinds of things. So there are more natural forms of noise production that are Gaussian distribution and others that are much more idiosyncratic.
Oh yeah, thank you very much. I got all my answers and satisfied with them. Really grateful for all this, for all the input of others. I'll be standing by and listening. KE2ALT, thank you.
Okay, very good, Ivan. Thank you for participating. You know where to find us if you need us. We're here every Sunday night after 8 o'clock.
Boy, you want another story about troubleshooting by sound?
Sure, Ed.
I once was doing some work at an RS-485 data box, and I just hooked it up to a phone work, and it was a fantastic, useful troubleshooting tool. Now, so the most people say, wait a minute, you need an expensive logic analyzer, this and that. And I agree totally, but that was not my objective. The beauty of RS-485 is it's a master slip. The master sends out a request. This thing responds. Sends out a request to another thing. It responds. But if something goes wrong, the master sends out a request, waits a while, sends out another request, waits a while. If you run it through a song alert, normally you hear that's wrong. But if there was something wrong, you go flip, flip, flip. And I can tell immediately if everything was talking, if there was something in trouble, the further trouble.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, especially when you're familiar with devices that occasionally tend to misbehave. If you're clever about it, you can discern the characteristics of the failure mode, if you will. So that's an interesting one. Yep, as always. Your signal's rather noisy tonight.
You're not going to make me go out the range and use a good antenna on the tank, are you?
No, I would never do that to you, Ed. Just pointing it out, because maybe you just need to tilt the antenna 10 degrees or something.
No, I'm using my standard position for the HD with my halfway in.
Okay, but yet that short interval was more readable than the previous one. So whatever you did for that short version of time, it worked better, whatever that might be. But I don't want you to get wet, Ed. We need you dry.
I think I just have to hold it vertical.
Okay, whatever works.
K0BD.
Yes, Ryan.
I just want to put my name in the queue for a question, that's all.
Okay, consider yourself in the queue. Any other comments before we move on?
82VHD?
Yes, Jim.
I just wanted to make a comment on Ed's signal. While his voice is the strongest of anybody on ham radio that I know of, his signal tonight is terrible, and his audio is even worse. So, Ed, I think something's wrong over there. We're used to hearing you better than that. And you don't have to get wet, but I just wanted you to know your signal quality.
Well, let me see if it's anything.
By the way, for you people keeping count of the IRLP, we lost the new old Canadian repeater. We're back down to one Canadian repeater and ourselves on the IRLP node. Well, we're giving Ed a little bit of time to see if he can fidget with the machinery and have a better audio quality. I understood him when he fixed the antenna straight up, so that shouldn't be a terrible problem, and I certainly don't want him to get wet tonight.
I could go out to the car and use the mobile, but with this setup, for some reason, the radio isn't happy unless the engine's running. I don't know if I want to do that.
It's okay, Ed. You know, I mean, you're not as readable as usual, but you're certainly still readable, and, you know, sometimes we're off, you know. There are days that the repeater just doesn't want to listen to my signal no matter what I do, and I'm stuck using something like Echolink for it. Anyway, this continues to be AC2GS, this continues to be the Limar Technical Net. Next on our list, Ryan K0BB. What's your question or your topic for tonight, Ryan?
Yeah, K0BB. My question relates actually to the discussion we were having the last time I was on the TechNet about this communication system in the 33-centimeter range. But I guess my general question is just without background, is how do you go about systematically mapping repeater coverage and testing how would you go about doing that in an urban area, especially in a 33-centimeter band? Like, you had a 33-centimeter repeater, and you went to test it at different heights, different locations. How would you go about systematically sort of mapping out the coverage area of that repeater, K0BB? I can give more background as well, if you like.
I do have a generic comment.
Well, Ed, if you have a comment, please comment.
Urban area with all those steel buildings, I think you're on a one-way trip to the moon phase.
Okay, so that is, let me just check that I have the repeater. Okay, that translates to some other people as this is going to be a tough one. But getting back to the actual question, Ryan, I don't know how you do it without a lot of shoe leather. There's no finesse way of handling it. You kind of just have to have signal strength meters, use hopefully portable radios, and go from point A to point B and take recordings and measurements. And they're going to be subject to change, unfortunately. So you might, if you make any changes, you have to go back to the same place. So it's a lot of shoe leather and a lot of time, as far as I'm aware.
And is it two-dimensional or three-dimensional?
Well, probably to make it just that much more work, three-dimensional, I would guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, let me say, I'm not looking to actually make, like a map. I'm really looking to gather data on, like, propagation and just sort of averages, right? Like, how far in this environment would it travel during this time of day? You know, how good is the signal reception at this time of day? in this area, just to kind of, I'm not looking to get like a map in terms of like, you know, left turn, right turn, this is where the signal strength is. I'm more like trying to gather sort of realistic data. I know about propagation models in urban areas, the theoretical limits of, you know, of path, signal path loss. It's just like, what does that actually mean in New York? Kind of my point. K0.
All right. Serious answer, Roy?
Yes, please.
You're x-raying the buildings to find out where the IDs are. You'll find that swamps everything else.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the problem is that if you want to have a kind of academic answer to it, you could provide generic models. But if you want an accurate assessment of the metropolitan area, you kind of got to know the topology. You have to know what building is where and what it's made out of. Is it made out of concrete? Is it made out of a lot of steel? Because all that's going to have a major effect on it. So, you know, simple modeling for a generic city is probably not going to be adequate for your what you need to do.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I wanted to do this. My plan was to just set up, the kind of the main repeater node somewhere, maybe in my apartment or something, and then just, or somewhere else, right, and just drive around with an antenna on the car, right, gather noise levels, gather signal-to-noise ratios, get the received power, you know, just, we're looking to test the viability of the system rather than get, like, exact measurements of, like, where the noise is or something. I just want to get, like, how far could this actually work, how many repeater nodes would I have to have in the system to make it work, how far apart would they be. That's sort of my primary purpose is, again, just more averages and kind of vetting an idea rather than, you know, trying to get an exact sort of ideal situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's your best approach. Like I said, either shoe leather or tire rubber, whatever is vehicle means of transportation, and you decide how many points of reference you have and see what it vaguely looks like. You might be able to draw a lot of conclusions just by a rough approximation of a bunch of randomly selected sites that you go out and record the signal strength. That might have been Jim in the background that was trying to get our attention, so if that was you, Jim, with a comment or a question, please hit that push-to-talk.
That was me, KD2VHD, Jim. It's an interesting question proposed, and I've heard it many times as I've been trying to develop my own local network with simple systems. And everybody that gets involved wants to answer that question. They want to map the whole thing out and model it. And I'll tell you this, it's about as relevant as mapping out how much salt you should use on your pizza. Everybody's got to figure out where they're at in the whole thing. You can ballpark it a little bit. Let's say that system you were talking about will work in a neighborhood versus a borough versus a city, and just give a rough estimate. But it's the other stations that have to figure out where they're at with the whole thing. And then trying to tell other stations what will work, whether it's in your own personal system or within a social network, they'll use as much salt as they want on their pizza and have to figure that out for themselves. That's my experience. Back to that.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Yeah, I think Ryan just kind of wants a ballpark sense of what's going on. I don't think he's expecting anything to three significant digits.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the other thing about it is that this system is not like an amateur radio system where you have maybe five or six nodes set up long distance, and you're talking about amateur stations who have knowledge. This is the actual system to get background would be lots of small repeaters around the city, and it would be used by citizens on the unlicensed band in the 33 centimeter range. So yeah, it's a little bit different requirements, but again, like I said, I'm trying to see how viable that system would be, you know, given the urban environment. Because, you know, obviously I can run the model, but it's like, you know, if I'm trying to make a simulation, I want real data on noise and stuff. K0.
Yeah, well, like I said, there's two leather rubber tires and what have you. You get a couple of data points, take a good look at it, see if it's helping or hindering, and if it's helping you, extend the data points as necessary until you have a good sense of what the picture is showing you, and then stop there, because you could spend the rest of your life sampling things and documenting them.
You guys actually doubled perfectly, but I understood you both. So thank you, K0BB, back to that.
Okay, it's always nice when you can hear both people doubling.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but that's really helps.
Well, it's that nice hum in the background. You know, it adds a little musicality.
K2SPP.
Yes, Chris.
I missed the beginning of that, so I don't, maybe you've covered this already, but there is, I used to design Wi-Fi networks for the company I worked at, and there's software that does what's called a heat map, and I'm sure if you Google it, you could find, there's probably shareware out there. You do a heat map, you put in the height of the antenna, the size of the antenna, the frequency, and the wattage you're putting out. Put some of the surroundings if you're in buildings or hills or mountains or whatever, and it gives you a basic idea on coverage from that antenna, and you can put several of them, and it draws colors and a pretty picture of a map of what gets covered and what will be missing. But as Roy said, it's a little bit of smoke and mirrors. It does work somewhat, but you know, it's not going to be exact until you try it. But I would look that up. It's called a heat map. They're generally for Wi-Fi, but I'm sure it'll cover other frequencies as well. K2SDP.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Ed, you wanted to comment.
No smoke. All serious. I was once in a hall of mirrors about 10 years old. I haven't seen it since, but you can know what a hall of mirrors is. At RF, the world is a hall of mirrors, and it's a function mostly of the metal around you, and that blocks out all those other things.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you, Ed, that it'll give you an answer. How accurate it is, if anyone guess, probably it's more accurate than throwing dice, but not much more accurate than throwing dice. So, yeah, when you're dealing with a known quantity like Manhattan, with so many variables of you know, there are buildings with a lot of steel in them, there are buildings with not that much steel in them, you know, it's very, very difficult to do modeling without a lot of information or really a lot of walking around and looking things up. I couldn't quite make that one out.
Ticket sensing, TICKET FENCING.
Yes, indeed, the joys of ticket sensing.
Multipath in action.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, look, multipath, I knew multipath when I was a little kid. You know, I was the kid in charge of holding the rabbit ears in the right position so that the multipath signals didn't give us a triple image of the TV set. It was just a double image.
You got it.
Yes, indeed. I've known of the joys of multipath since I was a little pup.
K0BB, let me see if I have it. Yeah, I was going to say, this all sounds really good. I see that it's kind of a fool's errand, and actually it might even be not that relevant. I mean, really what I was trying to gather is my envisioning is the system is going to have almost like kind of street level repeaters that are repeating low power signals, you know, to kind of central nodes. The central nodes would be higher up. So my question was really like trying to figure out how many blocks to put the street level repeaters apart, and then how high to put, you know, how many of these central nodes I would need, and how far apart they would need to be. That's kind of the information I was trying to gather for a simulation. But it sounds like it's not super important, actually. Again, this is a digital mode that's sensitive down to, like, negative 140 dBm received signal, so maybe it's not that big of a deal. All right, well, thank you so much, K0BD. I'll let it go back to that and listen to those of you comments.
No, Roy, you're 6 months away. You want to know why?
Why?
NUCDL is worked on UFC from the Department Radio, and unfortunately passed away in the last month. But if you were still around, you probably could give a 3-hour lecture on that very subject.
Yes, indeed. Andy could have given us a lecture on 1,001 different subjects, and I miss him, and I miss him on the technical net, and I miss talking to him almost a couple times a week on the telephone. But yeah, he was in the deep of it, you know, where it was really important, police and fire department and such. Well, I think in the case, Ryan, the better, the benefit of this technology that you've decided upon is that it is a mesh system where, except for collision detection problems, the more nodes you have, the better. So you might want to get an idea of what the bare minimum is and then probably have some kind of fault excessive addition to that number anyway.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There was something else. Oh, the other thing I was going to say is I do have a friend similar, I don't know, like, you know, the same vintage as Andy, unfortunately, but I do have a friend who does similar radio installs around the city on rooftops. He told me that 915 megahertz could go about 3 blocks. So maybe 3, so maybe I'll just go with that answer then and be done with it. K0PG.
Okay, I don't know how he bases this. I guess if you kind of average the amount of structures and buildings and such, because, you know, if you get it up high enough elevation, it's point to point. It could go a lot farther than that. It's not going to drop off as precipitously purely due to free space loss and free blocks. So I guess he has practical experience with that frequency range in the environment that you're talking about, which is a different case than just free space attenuation loss alone.
Yeah, he absolutely does. And actually, we were talking about it specifically street level repeaters on stoplights. So the conversation was pretty targeted based on his experience and on the problem at hand. K0.
AC2GO. Yeah, well, that's the best type of a person to get the information from. I mean, you could talk to professors and they'll draw you the equation for free space losses and such, but that's a useless thing. That, you know, if you live in a theoretical world, which none of us do, so there's a practical world where he's kind of played around in that backyard. He kind of knows what to expect of it. There's probably better information than any textbook could give you. Oh, well, thank you, Ryan, for participating. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. We still have about 15 minutes. If anyone's interested, has a question or a comment to make, please do it now.
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
A somber note. I continue to be amazed at how large the void Andy left. Passing is, those of you who are friends with him for decades obviously know that, but I knew him a much shorter amount. But wow, what a void.
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean, Andy was involved in so many different things with so many different people that it's not just one big void. It's a few thousand voids all over the damn place. I only wish he kind of had a better inkling of how valuable he was to all of us. He was a very humble guy. So I tend to prefer guys who are smart and don't act as though they know it than people who know it only too well and suffer fools gladly. So yeah, it's his loss is a great loss to all of us and continues to be. Sure, Ed.
Dozens, if not hundreds, of honorary brothers.
Yeah, I agree with you. We had a memorial the following Sunday night. Instead of the usual technical net, we just did a memorial for him. And his brother-in-law is an amateur radio operator, and he was able to get into the repeater to just kind of say hello, but it was very touch-and-go kind of reception, so we couldn't really have a good conversation on the repeater. But one of the things I wanted to do with the TechNet is just to demonstrate that, you know, ordinarily, if you just saw it on the superficial, Andy was interested in radio components and electronic parts and technical things, but there's a slew of us standing right behind all of those electronic parts that he was very important to. So it's not just that he knew how to fix stuff, but he touched a lot of fellow human beings along the way. Well, I'd love you to expand upon that, but again, you signaled this time it's actually even falling out of the repeater for a few seconds at a time.
I don't quite understand that. Maybe for this I should just go out to the car and start it up.
Well, this past transmission was okay, so I don't know what positional changes you tend to make between transmissions. So there's got to be, there's some positions that are probably a little bit better than others.
I have found I get the best access to the repeater lying down in bed with the travel long antenna on the HD, almost but not quite being filled.
Okay, I mean, whatever works, works. What can I tell you?
All right, so give it a try?
Yeah, give it a try.
Many years ago, 1974, we were flight testing a proposed replacement for the instrument landing system, the microwave landing system. For reasons I will never understand, it never actually happened. But we were flight testing it at Wallace Island, Virginia, which is near and dear to Falls Heart. And we had our equipment mounted on a World War II vintage 4-engine cargo plane, 54, aka DC-4. and we were flying microwave landing system approaches. And we had a so-called cross point indicator on the panel, and the pilot, you know, would try to fly the plane down the beach. And they told us that the beam had offended. Let me let it drop. They said at one point the beam would start to diverge, and they decided to just, you know, they learned rapidly, just ignore it, and a few moments later it came right back. So we spoke about this, and we got an idea, borrowed a surveyor's Granger, which is kind of like, you know, a rifle control, really, and put it right at where the beam, you know, where the light slope intercepted the runway, and off the side of the runway, we set this thing up, we're watching the plane come in, while listening on the radio, we realized just as the plane flew over the mosquito screen, it dropped about 10, 20 feet. And then when it passed over the creek and back over the grassy field before the runway, there was some, you know, noisy rising air, stopped over the creek, and went to a downdraft and back to an updraft. And they had no idea. They did not sense it at all, but our equipment was picking it up. Did I get through?
Yeah, it was a bit noisy, but it got through.
So we see that the mosquito effect.
Okay.
But it shows, A, it's not that easy to bend the 5 GHz in midair. And B, it is very easy for an airplane to do something that the pilots don't even notice.
So, okay, things to learn and remember, and probably very useful information for those people. I mean, unfortunately, data is very important, and you're never 100% sure that you have all of it. You just have to hope that you have most of it.
Comment?
Yes, Jim.
Seems is yet another potent reminder that while modeling is a very good tool to learn from, it's a very sad thing to trust.
I hope, let me make sure I have the repeater. Okay, don't want to double again. I think hopefully most people understand that, know that. Modeling is a tool. It's of some benefit. I don't think anyone should fully rely on a model unless they have absolutely nothing else to go on, and then I wouldn't feel terribly comfortable. But models are very important, but they have to be assessed as models. They're not reality. And every so often I used to do the science talk, and I would read about, I would discuss some new model that suggests some behavior of nature, and I would try as best I could to caution people that this is based solely on a theoretical model that may or may not be accurate. So, you know, sprinkle a couple of grains of salt on it. But, you know, models are important, but they shouldn't be overly important.
I have a great example.
Okay, Ed?
Remember a few months ago they crashed a spacecraft into an asteroid that was orbiting another asteroid?
Yeah.
I don't have proof of this, but it is blatantly obvious to me the purpose of that exercise. They had modeled what you could do. The beauty of having a small asteroid orbiting a larger asteroid is they knew exactly what the before picture was, and they could find out exactly what the after picture was. And they had every reason to be able to model that view. But considering the objective of this thing is to see about the quaking asteroids and possibly saving human civilization, They want to know that they had the model right. They spent God knows how many millions of dollars to run that just to verify that the results were exactly what the model predicted.
Well, I mean, that's an incredibly important bit of information. It's always good to test your models against reality. It's very bad to explain reality based on models that are unproven, which scientists have been known to unfortunately do repeatedly when they couldn't test their models properly.